begin now with Lecture 8, which is Mark Fu's Theory of Class and Modern Restatements. And there's such a good connection between the discussion that we had in the first hour today on social identities and this effort to do a little bit of rethinking of the theory of class as a theory of collective action. And as I mentioned, we will also be talking about collective action in the third lecture, in the lecture about Chinese peasant rebellions from the 19th century. So there's quite a lot of continuity between these several lectures today. So the question, and I want to bring a contemporary Marxist angle on this question, but the general question is about popular politics and collective action. The question is, why do people sometimes, but not always and not predictably, why do people come together and mobilize around common goals? Why is it that things like riots, uprisings, strikes, rebellions, and revolutionary movements occur? Why do these things happen? Why do individuals make the choice to come together in groups and involve themselves in collective activities, which may be small scale and local, may be large scale and regional, may be national in scale, as the Chinese Revolution eventually was national in scale. Though the Chinese Revolution is very interesting because it had all of those degrees of scale. It had small local activities, it had regional activities, and eventually it, of course, had national level party and mobilization. And so the key question is, what are the interests and motivations that lead people to engage in collective action? Now, this is a particularly important question given the little bit of study that we did the last time on the collective action problem, or the public goods problem, that Mansur Olson, the author, had developed. And his point that even when individuals have a common interest, it often occurs that their private interests are contradictory to that common interest, and therefore they do not support the collective action or the collective purpose. Now, Marx offers a particular theory of collective action. His theory of political behavior is based on an analysis of the class structure of a given society, and he thinks of different social orders. He thinks of feudalism, of the slave order, of a peasant economy, of a capitalist economy. He thinks that in each of those economies, groups of people have materially defined common interests, and they have an objective interest in engaging in collective action. And so Marx believes that slaves, for example, in classical slavery in Rome, had an objective material interest in forming rebellious groups. Their interest was to come together and to assert their needs, assert their demands, and then to force the ruling slaveholding class to concede their demands. They had that material interest, but then the question is, under what circumstances do material interests manage to result in collective action and mobilization by groups of people? And Marx offers, in a sense, two different aspects of a theory of class. There is a structural theory, which says that people in similar economic circumstances are defined as being a group or a class. But there is a subjective definition as well, what Marx refers to as class for itself, or a subjectively defined class, or the idea that you and I were just talking about, people coming to recognize themselves explicitly as members of the slave class or the working class. So class, the subjective definition, is when I come to recognize myself as a worker and as having interests in common with other workers. What is interesting to notice is that these two definitions are not one and the same. you can be structurally defined as a member of the working class, and yet you may subjectively regard yourself as something else. I am an intellectual, I'm not a worker. Or I am really a member of the middle class, but I'm not a member of the working class. Or it could go the other way as well. I might, as a professor, incorrectly regard myself. I might say, I am a member of the working class, though in fact, my material circumstances are very different from other members of the working class. So in that case, I would be subjectively a member of the working class, but structurally, I would be a member of the intelligent class, intelligentsia, the intellectual class. So the structural definition defines class in terms of the positions within the economic structure or the positions within the property system. And Marx's analysis of the property system leads to the identification of a small number of classes, both major classes and minor classes, corresponding to the major elements or the major intersections of the property system. Class identity is, as I said, a related but distinct concept because it is an open question whether individuals who are defined and who occupy a similar position within a class, it is an open question whether they will come to have class consciousness or whether they will come to have a class identity. What is class consciousness? It is an identity, it is a social identity, in which an agent explicitly considers himself or herself as a member of a particular class. So this is a particular kind of social identity. We talked about women's identity, we talked about national and ethnic or religious identity. Class identity is an affinity which I establish or which comes to me identifying myself with the other people in my material circumstances. Now there is something a little bit weird about class identity, and it is a piece of theorizing about class which has had a very mixed reality in the 20th century. Marx believed that the proletariat was the proletariat wherever it occurred, in England, in Germany, in Switzerland, in China. The wage laboring proletariat constitutes one international class. And yet, it was very difficult to create the processes which would lead to a single international working class identity. Instead, English working class people came to regard themselves as English working class people, and Italian working class people had an Italian working class identity. The international socialist movement was interested in creating a class identity that went across nation, that was international. You may know that Marx's, the organization he supported, was the Working Men's International, kind of the predecessor of the International Communist Movement. And yet, it was tremendously challenging. In fact, it did not happen. Tremendously challenging to create one identity, which was a trans-European working class identity. The way that I know that it was very hard to do that is as soon as World War I broke out, the socialist, communist, working people's concept was working men of Europe unite. You are united in your interests, and this coming war is an imperialist war. It is a capitalist war. But in fact, the mass society of England, France, Germany, Italy, those working men, and sometimes women, lined up with their nation rather than with their class. So that's an interesting historical fact. But let's ask the question, how would a class identity emerge? How would a group of people go from being a structurally defined class, a group of people in similar material circumstances, to a group of people with a shared class identity? Well, one of the things which is important is the existence of traditions. And so if you consider the history of English or French working class society, what you find is a whole bunch of traditions which are really pre-capitalist traditions. So songs and practices and religious organizations and forms of solidarity, those forms of tradition are a very powerful basis for beginning to then mobilize a class identity. The material conditions of class identity are also important. An example that I always find very interesting is the class identity which people who are miners often come to. Miners, you know, the people who work underground. And it seems to be true in many, many different societies that miners have a particularly strong class identity. And you could ask the question, why is that? And the answer seems to be, on the one hand, they do have traditions. Miners have traditions and songs of being miners. But more importantly, they have material circumstances where they really depend on each other. That life in a mine, conditions of work are very dangerous. You need to be able to rely on your fellow workers, your fellow miners in times of disaster. Of course, I know there was a terrible disaster in China just a few days ago, a mine explosion. So in other words, one of the explanations for the emergence of a class identity is common circumstances of work, regular connection, regular interdependence and reliance on each other. But it's also interesting to note that those forms of direct connection would establish an identity which is a local identity. Maybe it's coal miners in, I don't know, does Shandong have coal mines? Where are coal mines found in China? Yeah, all over the place probably. Would we expect there to be a coal miner's identity that extends across many provinces in China? Well, that's a slightly more difficult question, because it may well be that the differences of kind of regional identities in the coal miners in Shaanxi versus Hunan, probably no coal mines in Hunan, I don't know, but it's an open question whether one class identity would emerge or whether the coal miners of Shaanxi would simply regard themselves as a group with little in common with the coal miners of another region in China. That's an open question. We would ask, what are the processes by which that class identity would be established in such a way as to be regionally common throughout China? So the crucial question then is, what are the micro foundations of class identity or of class consciousness? What are the concrete social processes which would lead to the emergence of class identification and class consciousness? Marx refers to some of the material conditions which lead to the emergence of class consciousness, and these are some of the most appealing sections, I think, of Marx's writing, where he refers to the normal social life of workers, smoking, drinking together, talking, laughing. His point is that it's through ordinary social contact and the conditions of material life that a class identity and a class consciousness is formed. It is the circumstances of work and labor. The point which other historians, not necessarily Marxist historians, have made, that group identities, especially among workers like lumberjacks, people who work in the forest, people who work in mines, people who work in large factories, those circumstances of common material life and everyday interaction, that these circumstances lead to, well, produce, are conducive to the emergence of specific features of class identification and class interdependence. Though, you can also ask the question, in a large factory, are there factors which work against the creation of class solidarity and class identity? And the answer is, yes, of course there are. The managers of factories, especially in the 19th century, and maybe in China today, were very much interested in not permitting the emergence of class identity and class solidarity. And so things like the discipline of not talking, the rules in a factory that say you can't talk to each other. You might say that has maybe a little bit to do with efficiency, but it has a lot to do with breaking down the solidarity and the connections between workers. So the simple theory that Marx puts forward, and I would say it's simple, in fact it's too simple, but the simple theory is that members of exploited groups will come to recognize the fact of their exploitation. They will come to recognize the common interests which they share with other members of the group. So the proletariat, let's say the English proletariat, let's say the European proletariat, let's say the world proletariat. At each stage, new questions emerge. So let's stick with the English proletariat. He believes that the English proletariat, initially just a bunch of separate individuals, but they come to recognize, this is the simple theory, they come to recognize we have a lot in common with each other, and there's another group which is exploiting and dominating us. So we have a common opponent, and we have common interests and circumstances. We will come to recognize that. We will come then also to have solidarity, and we will come to be able to be mobilized around our solidarity. And so the simple theory says social movements, the coming together of groups of people, small groups, eventually large groups of people, based on class identity, these social movements will arise to challenge existing exploitative property relationships and political institutions. This is the simple theory. This is Marx's theory of revolution, basically. It is the closing sentence of the Communist Manifesto. Working men of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. This is the idea that you have common interests, and then the false idea that you have nothing to lose. Well, everybody has something to lose, including working men. But then Marx takes the view, rebellion, collective action, and revolution, these are rational strategies of collective self-defense on the part of subordinate classes. I assert this is too simple a theory. And by the way, this, what I'm kind of going through today, comes out of the essay that is called Marxism and Popular Politics. So that's the place where I lay out my most basic criticisms of a simple Marxist theory of class identity. I think the theory is too simple for about 6 or 8 reasons. First of all, it ignores the social and individual factors that are crucial for the outcome. When Marx says, working men of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, he is papering over, he is ignoring the many differences, regional differences, industrial differences, differences in terms of religion and quality of life. There are many differences within that group of working men that he's speaking to. And the theory is not paying any attention at all to what the mechanisms are through which those groups begin to have broader and broader identities. It is a pure macro theory. It requires, according to me, but I think it's a reasonable expectation, it requires micro foundations. And so the micro foundations of class politics need to identify the other factors that are relevant to the emergence of political consciousness and collective action. In other words, we need to have just a good nuts and bolts theory of what is it which leads a group of people to come to have a broader identity, a broader consciousness of itself as a group. I once had a really interesting conversation with an Irish historian, and we were talking about the great potato famine that occurred in Ireland in the 1840s. And you probably know about this, but the potato was the main food source for Irish people in the early 19th century. And the potato was then blighted by a disease, and almost all potatoes died. And there was mass starvation in Ireland. I asked the question of this historian, why was there not a revolution in Ireland in the 1840s? There was wealth in Ireland, there was food in Ireland, but poor people and farming people did not have access to it because their only access was to potatoes, and potatoes were dead. So I asked the question, why was there not revolution? Why do you think there was not a popular uprising? against the propertied and the powerful in Ireland. And he said in this wonderful Irish accent, "Man, you can't be a revolutionary when you're starving." That in other words, there's a kind of basic material level of well-being that is necessary for people to be rebellious, that they will look for other means of solving their problems besides rebellion if the degree of suffering is too great. And as a matter of fact, the most common response to the Irish potato famine was to emigrate to America. That was when my ancestors came to America as a result of the great potato famine. So we need to have micro foundations, that's the point. We need to have an explanation of those social processes through which a group comes to have, or perhaps fails to come to have, a collective identity. And it's the more important because we are now somewhat familiar with the problems of collective action. We're more familiar with the obstacles to collective action. When Marx says, "Working men of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains," actually, it's incorrect. Each of those workers does have private ways of enhancing and improving his own conditions of work. You and I were talking about the essay about collective action in China, and the recognition that as a time when a factory is being bought out and people are going to be fired or they make another accommodation, each of the workers has to make a calculation, what's best for me? How will my family come out of this the best? And sometimes those accommodations mean come together and be collective. Sometimes the accommodations mean make a private deal, come up with a solution which works privately. So the public goods problems are tremendously important in the issue of class politics. And it is, I think it's demonstrable that revolution and rebellion are public goods, meaning if a rebellion is successful, it's successful for everyone, whether they contributed to the rebellion or they did not contribute. So every agent has a private incentive to be a free rider, to, in other words, benefit from the rebellious action, but not to contribute. And therefore, collective action problems and free rider problems impede solidarity, because solidarity or collective action is costly. The private solution is less costly, and therefore we expect that there will be a fair amount of free riding. But we also then need to notice that there are other, and this is why the connection between this lecture and the previous lecture is so important, there are other social conditions that give rise to group identities. Marx basically assumes that material and class facts are the most important facts. But I think that we now have a better understanding, and we understand that people's collective identities and their social identities come from many different things. They come from race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, region, family and lineage. So in other words, there are a lot of different ways in which people come to say, this is really who I am. I am a Hindu shopkeeper in India. I am a Jewish professor in New York. I am a homosexual artist in San Francisco. Each of those declarations is a different way of highlighting my identification with a group. And for each of them, we can come up with very good micro-foundational stories about how that comes to be the dominant identity. Because notice, a person can be Hindu, homosexual, business person, south of India. All of those facts are true of one person, and so the question is, which of them is the dominant identity? That is the question which social research has to help us answer. Why is it that Hindu nationalism becomes most important at one period of time in Indian history, and one's commercial and economic interests become more important at another point in time? What are the factors which lead to the one or the other? Furthermore, it's also worth noticing that people have cross-cutting identities. A person may identify herself as a feminist, member of the working class, North China advocate. In other words, a person may have each of these identities, and they may be partially reinforcing and partially conflicting. Moreover, even within a working class identity, it is commonly found when historians and maybe sociologists as well, when they study the class identities of a nation, they find that there are substantial differences between industries, for example, between the metal workers and the textile workers of England, or between the miners and the factory workers of China, or between, this is an example that had a lot of importance about 20 years ago in the US, between baggage handlers and air traffic controllers at airports. When there was a union of air traffic controllers and the union was dissolved by President Reagan, the other unions did not support the air traffic controllers because the air traffic controllers were thought to be a labor aristocracy. They were thought to be high and mighty. They're paid way too much, and we baggage handlers aren't paid nearly enough. In other words, the working class identities, even within the working class, are cross-cutting and sometimes conflictual. Marx has the simple theory, these differences begin to be less and less important, but actually the experience of the 20th century seems to be not so. Those differences continue to be important, whether it's industrial trade differences, it's regional differences. All of these differences continue to be important, and therefore, the identities and the solidarities which even working class groups form sometimes aggregate to larger national movements, but sometimes stay very local and regional and conflictual. Moreover, even if we thought material interests are the most important interests, and I've already kind of laid my cards on the table and have said, no, they're not the dominant fact. They're sometimes dominant, sometimes not dominant. But even if we thought that they were the most important, there are other material interests which can be a basis of mobilization. So in peasant politics, for example, access to water is an important material interest. But it's an interest which cuts across social class, so that it's more village-specific than it is class-specific. And so you can have material conflict over rights of use of a forest or a grazing area or a water resource, but those conflicts may be village against village rather than class against class. So in other words, even material interests can give rise to group solidarities which are different from the class solidarities that Marx expected. The last point here about gender-based differences, also terribly important. It is really interesting to know that the gender and agriculture complex in different societies is very different, where women are very empowered in certain kinds of agriculture and very disempowered in other kinds of agriculture. Women are permitted to own property, to own farmland and tools in one society and not permitted to in another society. Well, that has important consequences, both political consequences, but also identity consequences. This point about the level of group aggregation, I think, is a tremendously important point. Even if we take it as correct, even if we think empirically it is correct that working people who work in a factory tend to come to have some solidarity with each other, and even if we think that generalizes a little bit, so the people in the metal factory in Birmingham also have some degree of affinity with the metal workers of Manchester. In other words, even if we think there's some process of generalization within an industry, it is still an open question, what are the mechanisms that would lead metal workers and miners to begin to say, we have something important in common. In other words, how do we get to that more aggregated group? What is the basis of solidarity? This is an important point. What is the basis of solidarity across a full regional and occupational diversity of a class? And the answer that I would offer is, there is no natural basis. There is no reason to expect that there will be an emergent class consciousness that captures the whole region and the whole occupational range of occupations. Instead, Those larger solidarities will emerge just if there is an effective campaign by organizations and leaders to create those larger solidarities. In other words, basically, you need to have activists who are on the television, who are out in the villages, who are out in the shop floor saying, "You metal workers, don't be ignorant. You have more in common with the textile workers than you do with the bosses." In other words, you need to have an active political effort to broaden solidarity, to broaden collective identity, and that if that broader organizational effort does not occur, then it's very unlikely that the larger political solidarity of the working class would ever emerge. It is not automatic. So we need to know what are the mechanisms, and it's not too obscure. You know, once you start thinking, well, I'm the leader of the AFL-CIO, the American Federation of Labor in the United States, and I'm recognizing that Southern workers don't even think of themselves as potential union members. So what do I need to do? I need to send some union organizers to the South. I need to get some airtime on television. I need to elect a president who is more pro-labor. In other words, very concrete political strategies of mobilization and extension of a collective identity. It's clear enough what to do. It's very difficult to accomplish because intelligent opponents are also out there. So in each of those factories in the South, the factory owners are going to be discouraging. I mean, and sometimes they actually beat them up and kill them, and other times just fire them or discourage them from being present in the factory. We've got a bunch of great movies in the United States about that subject. But the point is that it's clear enough what social mechanisms would be needed in order to extend class solidarity, and those mechanisms may be successful or may not be successful. If they don't take place at all, we can be pretty confident there will not be a broader class solidarity. I also want to assert, and this is all by way of kind of criticizing and assessing Marx's theory of collective action, I want to assert that in addition to class factors, again, even taking the premise that class factors and material factors are an important form of mobilization, we also have to pay attention to other factors. There are other factors which determine whether a popular movement will become broader and more successful or will flare up, have a certain amount of visibility, and then die away. Now, what are some of those other factors? Political culture is one that I would refer to. French workers in the 1840s had a long tradition of effective, especially in Paris, so Parisian French workers, a long tradition of uprising. They kind of knew how to do it. You might say it's a part of their class inheritance, but you might just say it's a set of practices that they had learned. And so they knew how to pull up the cobblestones, to make the barricades, how to push over the little police posts. In other words, having a political culture that says when the government acts bad, the right thing to do is pull up the cobblestones. That's a political culture, and not every society obviously has that culture. In the United States, it's pretty remarkable how infrequently large mobilizations of people around political issues has occurred in the last century. There have been some riots in the United States, mostly around race. There has been one really powerful anti-war movement in the 1960s. But it's very uncommon for Americans to take part in large collective action, protests, let alone riot and rebellion. And why is that? Well, I think it has something to do with the political culture. It has to do with the assumptions that Americans have absorbed about, you know, how should a government behave, how should people behave, what's the right thing to do, what's the wrong thing to do. That kind of segues into the topic of traditions and repertoires of collective action, where here I'm referring to Charles Tilly, the American historical sociologist, who is just a brilliant writer, where he tries to document how it is that French workers and French underclass people came to have the periods of rebellion periods of what he calls contention over a period of three centuries. And one of the things he identifies is that there were pretty well-defined traditions of unrest. Kind of, it's almost like a cookbook. If the government does not take action to lower food prices, then take over the major government establishments in the major cities. Take over, now what does that mean? It means get 10,000 people to go to the mayor's office and just sit down. Maybe it means burning the tax records. In other words, the repertoire is a series of past actions which people kind of remember. This is what you do when the government acts badly. And it is demonstrable that different societies have different traditions. So Japanese people have different ways of protesting than French people and Chinese people. And what Tilley would assert, and I completely agree with this, is that these traditions are an historical resource for a people or for a bunch of groups of people. And it really kind of gives them both the resource but also the limitations. If Americans were better at protesting their government's actions, I think the American government would be quite different, he said with a little bit of a laugh. Another important topic is organizational resources, because Marx pays no attention to the way that an organization, a political party, possibly a revolutionary party, how an organization itself either facilitates through its intelligent action or maybe impedes through its stupid actions the ability of a collective action to occur. Now, why do you need organization? I think the answer to that is that collective action requires some degree of coordination. If there's one riot in Hebei about land seizures, one riot is easily contained. If riots occur or if collective actions occur in 100 cities at the same time, it is a much more challenging form of collective activity. Here I'm thinking of, for example, the Solidarity movement in Poland. Lech Walesa, you know, the leader of the Solidarity movement, and the workers' movement, which was a nonviolent movement, and it was based in a number of cities, but the strength of that movement was two things. It was the ability of the Solidarity movement to build solidarity, so that Polish workers were pretty energized about defending their interests. But secondly, the organization itself was able to coordinate and kind of give encouragement to activities in different cities at the same time. And so that ability to coordinate and to mobilize was an important feature in successful collective action. Again, Marx pays no attention to that subject. He talks about revolutionary consciousness, but he doesn't talk about organization, political culture, or leadership. And here we can talk about leadership. Why is leadership important? Well, it's important because there needs in some way to be an intelligent and maybe inspiring leader or group of leaders who are able to direct organization and to encourage followers. Why do leaders do what they do? Well, there's a whole theory which is referred to as political entrepreneurship, that leaders' behavior can be understood as being a rational effort to create certain kinds of social movements for their own benefit, basically, or for the benefit of their party. And so we can offer a rational choice theory of leadership, but we don't have to be deterministic about this. We can take it that Ho Chi Minh was both a calculating leader and also a Vietnamese patriot. In other words, it's not incompatible to say that leaders are both cultivating the interests of their party and also pursuing the good of the nation. And then finally, another factor that I think Marx's theory of popular politics does not take into account is the possibility of alliance with other groups within society. If you thought that the biggest problem in China today is the creation of vast enterprises which have a lot of power and are laying off lots of people, if you thought that was the most important social problem, a movement that was trying to address that problem might be more powerful if it was able to line up with people who were also concerned about the environment. So lining up with environmental groups, lining up with feminist groups, groups concerned about the situation of women in Chinese society, lining up with, and then lining up with, you know, these kind of material sorts of interests, those would be activities which are conducive to more effective collective action or popular politics. I wanted to refer here to a great, great book by E.P. Thompson, Edward Thompson, called The Making of the English Working Class, which is a book which is responsive to my demand there should be micro-foundations for class identity, because what E.P. Thompson does in this book, he looks at a 100-year period of time in the English working class, and he shows how that group went from being a heterogeneous group of people making saddles, people doing ironmongery, people farming, people doing the various skilled trades, in other words, a very heterogeneous group, to forging a more comprehensive group identity as the English working class. So when E.P. Thompson writes about making the English working class, he's really talking about the forging of a group identity through a 100-year period of time. And it is very, very interesting to realize that Thompson recognizes how contingent this process is, that the specific characteristics of the English working class could have been quite different depending on other leaders, other organizations, other religious movements. The outcomes could have been quite different, which I think is an important historical point. Coming towards the end here, is there a continuing role for Marx's theories of class? I'm just kind of offering my own opinions here, but I ask the question, is class relevant in analyzing social and economic change? I believe it is relevant. Class as defined in both ways, class as one's position within a system of property and surplus extraction. I continue to think that modern societies are systems in which surplus is being collected and then extracted by other groups in society. And if you think that's true, then class as being those who create surplus and those who extract surplus, that's a relevant analysis or analytical tool. Is it a complete theory of social mobilization and consciousness for the reasons I've just been going through? Absolutely not. Social identities and social consciousness are the result of many factors, including material factors, but including other factors which cut sideways, crossways. Is there anything inevitable about the emergence of class as a salient political factor? Again, no. I would say there's nothing inevitable at all. If we thought that class consciousness was an inevitable outcome, we would probably also think that it is inevitable that working class people in China will come to be more and more militant over time. But that's a possibility, but I would say it's only one possibility. Other possibilities are more accommodation, labor unions which are more accommodating, an agreement between state and business people and workers that is more satisfactory. In other words, there's nothing inevitable about the emergence of militant class identities. It is a possible basis of collective action. It is a fulcrum or a kind of lever point around which mobilization and organization can occur. But again, it's just one out of many. You could imagine a Hindu village in which the communist organizer, the Hindu nationalist, and the feminist organizer all arrive at the hotel at the same time, and they've got their brochures and pamphlets, and they're all competing for class identity, social identity, religious identity, and you know, some of them will succeed, but not all of them, and there's nothing inevitable that the communist organizer will succeed. And that is the end. But there was a nice connection here, I think, between the social identity discussion we had in the first lecture and the discussion of material and class identities here.